I'm Lieutenant Joe Pangaro. I've been a cop for 27 years. I like to say I got a backstage pass to life. Well, guess what? I got some tickets for you. So come on in, pull up a chair, turn up that volume, and let's go. Chasing Justice is on.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Chasing Justice here on the America Out Loud Radio Network. I'm your host, Lieutenant Joe Pangaro, and once again, it is a wonderful day to be here with you. So where am I today? So today we're coming to you live from Pigeon Forge, Tennessee. So you say to yourself, what is in Pigeon Forge, Tennessee? Well, Pigeon Forge, Tennessee is a beautiful part of the state of Tennessee near the Great Smoky Mountains, which is absolutely fantastic. If you've never been out here, you really need to make the effort to come and check it out. I was here with my son Alex going back, I don't know, about 8 or 9 years ago. And we came here and we just fell in love with the place. First of all, physically, it is absolutely gorgeous. The area, the mountains are so impressive. And the reason they call them the Smoky Mountains is that in the morning, there's a lot of, it's not fog, it's just the dew, I guess, from the area clings to the mountains and valleys. And if you overlook the mountain and valley, you will see the smoke coming up out of each valley over the mountaintop. It's just absolutely fantastic. Something that's really impressive to the soul. It can change the way you see the world. And it's right here in our country. It's not hard to get to. It's a little bit of a ride. You know, you fly into Nashville, and then you can drive about 3 hours to get to this area. Or you could certainly drive here. When Alex and I drove down, it took us 14 hours from New Jersey to get here. But it's absolutely beautiful. So what am I doing here? What is Lieutenant Joe doing in Pigeon Forge, Tennessee? Well, there's a thing down here called NASRO. It's the National Association of School Resource Officers. They're having a convention down here. It's a lot of training for the officers. They come from all over the country. And they are the guys and girls that go into our schools and act as police officers in the schools. They protect our kids, you know, from this horrors of school shootings, other kinds of violence, depending on what's going on in the school district. So they have a convention, and I'm down here with True Security Design and our partners from IP Video, who make the Halo device, which I've told you all about. You've seen those videos. Fantastic. It is a real vape device. It can pick up THC. It can pick up marijuana. It can pick up regular vape. It can pick up all kinds of caustic chemicals in the air. Really cool. So we're down here talking about the training I do for law enforcement to try and bring that training to the cops that are down here and try and help this area out. So that's what we're doing. So between today and I guess tomorrow and the next day, I'll be doing a couple of speeches on school safety and security and meeting lots and lots of really wonderful people. And they're all out here trying to do the same thing, keep our kids safe. So if you have a school resource officer in your school district where your kids go, get to know that officer. They're really good and decent people. They choose a difficult career path. You know, working in schools and working with kids is not the same as, you know, chasing people down into police cars and kicking doors and doing narcotics work and all that other kind of stuff that everybody sees is so glamorous. You know, they're working day to day with kids who have problems, making sure that, you know, schools have, they have somebody around that the kids can turn to, an authority figure that will listen to them. You know, it takes a special temperament to work in a school. You can't just have anybody show up in the school. So I want to say hats off if you're a school resource officer and you're listening out there in Chasing Justice Land. Thank you for the work you do. It is really very important. And I hope I see you here if you're at NASRO, because I'll be back again next year. It's really, really great. All right, so where are we going this week? What else are we going to talk about? Well, justice. Justice as a concept has many, many components. Justice, of course, is things should work out the way is fair and equitable and proportional. I think that's an important word. We're going to get to that in a little bit when we talk about some things the president did. But fair, just, equitable, proportional, this is really the concept of justice. So we talked a few weeks ago about Navy SEAL Gallagher, who's on trial for his life, because they're saying that he killed a prisoner while at wartime. And I wasn't saying it would be conflicted when we talked about this, because I don't think that's the right word. But I think the reality is this. We send these men and women into these war zones, especially in this modern era. We have been at war continually since 9/11. We've put these men and women into these positions to interact with people from foreign countries that are, for the most part, completely different types of cultures than we're used to in the United States, which is a burden already for them because they have to try and figure that out. Then you have people who want to kill them, people who are plotting against them constantly. You have entire governments that are corrupt, that are pretending that they're helping us and they're really not. I mean, look at bin Laden. How long was he hiding in Pakistan all those years? Hiding there and people telling us they didn't know where he was. And he was a guy that did such a horrible thing to our country. So you can't really trust these governments that run some of these countries, you know, where we're fighting, Afghanistan, Pakistan, all these other places. So we talked about Navy SEAL Gallagher on trial, and an interesting thing has come up. Someone else has now come forward, another military person, and said that they were the one who actually killed the prisoner that Gallagher is charged with killing. So what is that? Is that real? Is that really what happened, or is this some kind of complex attempt to foil the trial? You know, if you have somebody who was on trial for what any kind of crime, and someone else comes forward in the middle of that trial and says, "Hey, listen, by the way, I actually did the crime." What are you supposed to do? What would be just at that point? Do you stop the trial? Do you then investigate this other person to determine whether or not they actually did it? Or are they just coming forward to say this to disrupt the trial? Well, I think let's look at the first alternative. You continue with the trial. You continue with the trial. And say Navy SEAL Gallagher is convicted. He's convicted of a murder, of a war crime, basically, what they're going to convict him of. And it turns out he didn't do it. Someone else did it. Now that person comes forward and we investigate it and turns out, yes, they did. What do we do? Go back and how do you give Navy SEAL Gallagher back his reputation and his life? How do you repay him? Isn't that an injustice? Right? That's not equitable. That's not fair. And that's not proportional. So as I was thinking about this, I'm trying to figure out where I stand on it. And lo and behold, I was watching Fox News, and who pops on but Sergeant Derek Miller. Sergeant Derek Miller was assigned to our war zone, and he was working in a camp, and I believe it was in Afghanistan, an American base. And there was a man who showed up on the base, a local civilian showed up on the base, and he was suspicious. And they initially investigated him, and they found that he had information or access to a group of people that had weapons, fuel, all the things of war that you need to attack this base. And after their initial investigation, this person was allowed to leave and told, do not come back to the base. You're not allowed back on this base. Don't come back here again. Which you can question that all you want. I don't have the specific facts of why he was let go, what they thought. Obviously, they didn't have anything to hold the man on at that particular point, so they told him to get out of the base and don't come back. Now, to us, that might sound strange, but you got to remember, where these bases are located, we are in the middle of a war zone. There are people all around those bases who are looking to attack and hurt our soldiers. So the fact that someone who has access to those kind of people and weapons, those weapons are everywhere in that war zone. So I guess they're looking for actionable information, something that's, you know, bedrock true, and they can point to it and say, hey, here's exactly what's going on. Whatever, they let this guy go. A short time later, Sergeant Miller says he observes this person back at the base again. And he went to his commanding officer and he said, listen, I want to go question this guy again because something's wrong. He's back here again. So the commanding officer does the right thing, says, go ahead. You got something to ask him about, go ask him. So Miller grabs him and starts having a conversation with this guy. And apparently the story that the guy had starts falling apart. It becomes pretty obvious. I investigated people for years and years and years. I teach interview and interrogation. I teach a course called Street Interview. And that's for people who are working out in the street as opposed to, you know, like you see on TV and the detectives bring somebody into the interview room. It's a totally different dynamic, different psychology involved. So when you're out on the street, you often don't have the same dynamics at work. So you need specific techniques to elicit those emotions and get people to tell you things. It's a long story, but Sergeant Miller is out there interviewing this person, and their story starts to fall apart to the point that Miller starts to realize this person has more information than he's letting on, and it's about an attack on this base or on soldiers who are going to be moving throughout that community. And Miller decides he's got to get this information. Now, this is where the story, this is where it diverges from what we're used to in American justice. And we start to think about how the police operate in America and how the military have to operate in a war zone. And we can discuss what I'm going to tell you next in an entire different block. Maybe I'll get some people in to talk about it. But what Miller does is he realizes this man has more information, vital information, actionable information about an attack that seems imminent. And what he does is the man won't tell him. The man's lying to him. So Miller pulls his service weapon, his handgun, and points it at the man. And now demands him to tell him, where are the soldiers? When is the attack coming? Who are these people? That sounds a little drastic, right? Sticking a gun in somebody's face. It's hard for us to comprehend that because we're so used to American law enforcement. American police would never do a thing like that. All right, you could never stick a gun in somebody's face because you want to know when the bank robbery is going to take place or who the drug dealer is, even a murderer. You know, you can't stick a gun in their face and tell them where's the body or where's the person that's missing. So we find that antithetical to our sense of justice. But let's take a minute and let's go back. Let's say it's World War II, and you have a Nazi tank compound moving your way to attack an American position, and you catch a Nazi soldier, and he won't tell you anything. Would you be less shocked to hear that they stuck a gun in his face and said, you better tell us where that tank column is coming towards our troops? Wouldn't you be less surprised about that? Well, this is the same kind of thing. We're talking about men and women who are at war. They don't have time for the niceties of law enforcement that we are blessed to have in the United States. You know, the Constitution of the United States is just that, the Constitution of the United States. Once we leave the confines of America, we're out in the rest of the world. You know, the rest of the world where they torture people, where they beat them, where they murder them, they do all kinds of things. So to be shocked that an American soldier would stick a gun in a guy's face and say, you better tell me where the attack is coming, seems less bizarre in the surroundings of that environment, in a war environment. Now, Sergeant Miller says, I had no intention of killing the man. He was using the gun as an intimidation tool because, you know, people get shot and killed over there all the time. So he was hoping that this man would feel the immediate jeopardy, that his life was in danger if he did not give up the information. And we can argue about the tactic all day long. You got to remember, you're not talking about American law enforcement. You're not talking about the police doing this to you on the side of the road because they think you know something about, you know, some carjacking or some nonsense. We're talking about something here where there was an imminent terrorist attack on military, American military soldiers or their base. So Miller sticks this gun in the guy's face. Tell me where the attack is coming from. Apparently, there were people who saw this and testified that that's what Miller was trying to do. Well, the man, at some point, reaches up and grabs the pistol. And now they're having a fight over Sergeant Miller's pistol. And Sergeant Miller, in the course of that fight, fires a round to stop the fight. Now, he didn't give any indication that he was losing the fight, whatever. The point was, the man grabbed the pistol and they start fighting over it. And Sergeant Miller fires a round and the man dies, kills him. Well, he's arrested and he's charged with a war crime, killing a civilian. That's what he was charged with, killing a civilian. There was a trial. He was convicted and he served 9 years in military prison for, you know, this war crime. Now he's on a mission with several other people to make his case known, but not only his case, the case of many other soldiers who are languishing in military prisons, American military prisons, for similar kinds of events. So before we go any further, I think what we need to do here is we need to delineate some of the things we're talking about. And the reason I brought up the fact that it's not American law enforcement, what we're used to, it's a different world. I think we must, if we are to be just, we have to understand the situation we put these men and women of our military in and the way that people, human beings, are going to react to the environment that they are in. This removes, was it right or is it wrong, from the argument. We'll deal with that separately. Let's look at the environment we put these military people in. They're not in America. They're out in the world where the rules are completely different. All right? The rules are completely different in the rest of the world than they are in beautiful America, in beautiful downtown Pigeon Forge, Tennessee. You know, the rest of the world doesn't follow rules the way we do. The rest of the world doesn't have the constitution we have. The rest of the world is trying to kill these men and women at every opportunity. And we see, we're still, after all these years, we're still losing our military personnel overseas in this anti-terrorist campaign we're trying to fight to keep them from coming here to America and killing you and your family. So taking the right or wrong out of Sergeant Miller's actions of pointing a gun in a guy's face to get the information, I think anecdotally, we would all probably look at that and say, well, hey, if that worked and the guy told him where the troops were, where the bombs were, where the guns were, and we could save all those people, you would do it. It's when we stick justice into the picture, right and wrong, we say, I don't know if that was the right thing to do from one human being to another. And this is where this is very, very confusing. You know, what is right and wrong in that situation? You have a man who's serving his country, and he has information that the person in front of him is about to be a part of or has knowledge about an attack on the military where soldiers are going to be killed. And you have to get that information. So you're not going to read him his Miranda rights. You're not going to ask him nicely. You're not going to sit there and try and appease his sense of do the right thing, sir, and tell us where these terrorists are. You need to get that information right then and there to prevent the loss of life of the military people. In that context, you have to take the game up a notch. Okay, so in America, when I interview people, I try to use psychological pressure. That's part of an interview, of a criminal interview. You use jeopardy and you use psychological pressure and the concerns about the consequences of their actions. And then you play on their sense of, you know, was this an improper thing that you did? Was this something that you should be ashamed of, etc.? All that is psychological pressure. When you're over in a war zone, you don't have time for those niceties. And I'm trying to understand this. And I'm trying to say what Sergeant Miller is saying is that we have lots of American soldiers who are in prison for doing the similar kinds of things that you and I have demanded of them. We have sent them over there to protect us. Now, if there's a wanton murderer amongst our people who just likes to kill for no reason, that's something we have to weed out. I agree with that. But to take these men and women who are simply doing the best that they can under ridiculously horrible situations, life and death, in a world that is not America, and force them to act as though they're in downtown Pigeon Forge and how they would treat someone, I think is totally inappropriate. So I want you to think about that for a few minutes. What is justice? Is there justice for these soldiers being locked up for all these years because of something that happened in a war zone? I'm inclined to think not. This is Chasing Justice with Lieutenant Joe Pangaro. We'll be back in a few minutes.
Well, the Out Loud perspective awaits you in life, love, politics, a healthy lifestyle, your faith, personal development, and living an out loud life on AmericaOutLoud.com. Blitzer News and Entertainment Network, where you can listen 24/7 on our free apps on both Android and Apple. Welcome to the new era in communications, America Out Loud Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome back to Ding, 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 Round 2 here on Chasing Justice on the America Out Loud Radio Network. You know, I guess our theme today, and you know I like themes, Our theme today is justice, because that's what this program is called, Chasing Justice, trying to find justice in the world on the big scale and trying to find justice on a small scale. Isn't that something we're all kind of caught up in at different parts of our day, different parts of our life? You get an argument with a coworker over something, right? And you get in trouble because of something you said or did. And it's just not right. You were meaning to do one thing and it came out another way. That's not just. And that's why I chose that title for this program, Chasing Justice, because in law enforcement, that is the whole idea of law enforcement. You are pursuing justice at every turn. Everything that you do is for justice. But in life, the bigger picture of justice is sometimes clouded, like the case of the military people we're talking about. You know, that whole way they're being treated, we're trying to figure it out as a people. You know, this is kind of new. When it was World War II, World War I, we kind of knew what the deal was. We saw the world differently then. Now, in modern world, we're much more enlightened. As every day goes by, we are much more enlightened on human nature and how we should not behave, and a lot of rot gut, I think. When it comes down to it, when people are in desperate situations, they will do desperate things. And the more we try and pretend, the more we try to be politically correct about everything that we do, the more danger we put on ourselves. And that's a component of this. That's a component of this. Is there political correctness in this? Is it too toxically masculine for a soldier to get the information out of a terrorist to protect people, because he does it in a way that, that sounds so terrible? Or do we have to live in the bright light of the real world and say, if there was a chance that the man Sergeant Miller was talking to had to stick a knife in his throat, he would probably do it, right? Sergeant Miller wouldn't have much of a chance against the people who were on the side of the man who got killed, right? They would destroy Sergeant Miller and every one of our soldiers, and they wouldn't think twice about it. Matter of fact, they would be heralded as heroes. But here in America, we have Sergeant Miller do his duty in the best way he thought possible in a most horrific environment, and we want to condemn him. We put him in prison. I have a little bit of a problem with that. I don't think that's right, and I want to wish Sergeant Miller luck in what he's trying to do. Now, you have to constantly clarify because of that political correctness. All right, we have to constantly clarify what we're saying. I'm not saying that an American serviceman who just has a proclivity to kill, who might be a serial murderer back here in the States when they were not on duty, should just be allowed to willy-nilly go through the war zone and kill civilians. I'm not saying that. We protect civilians. That's part of American justice. We protect civilians. Even our enemy, when we capture them, we treat them as decently as is possible compared to everyone else in the world. So let's be clear about that. I'm not saying that American service personnel should be able to just kill anybody they want in a war zone. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is we have to look at the circumstances of each and every one of these incidents, and we give the benefit of the doubt to our people. Political correctness be damned. Now, I say that about the war zone, and I'm going to say that about our cops too. Because you know what? This is really becoming horrific. Look how many of my brother and sister police officers are being murdered and killed and maimed every single day in this country. And at first it was really starting to bother people. It's kind of disappeared now, hasn't it? Do you really see the outrage? Every day you hear about a new killing of an officer, a new ambush of an officer. What are we doing, ladies and gentlemen, as a society, that you and I, you know, the decent people, that we're not standing up and screaming and hollering, demanding that something be done? I don't know. You know, my brother on this radio network, Lieutenant Randy Sutton, has a tremendous program going, and you really should listen to Randy's program. He's a guy who's seeking justice for law enforcement, and he really is a good and decent guy, and his show is excellent, as are many other programs here on America Out Loud. So I want you to go listen to Lieutenant Randy and catch up on everything that he's doing, because just a tremendous man, and he is really caught up in the whole trying to protect our police officers and dealing with these constant murders. So I get far afoot of myself, as I am sometimes prone to do when I get off on my rants. So the idea of the justice is that's what we're looking for. And these military personnel and our law enforcement officers need the benefit of the doubt when they're out there doing the dirty work that society demands of them, whether it's off in Afghanistan or whether it's in the streets of Pigeon Forge, Tennessee. Sometimes interacting with other human beings who are doing bad things makes things go sideways. And when it comes down to giving the benefit of the doubt, that benefit of the doubt should go to the guys and girls of law enforcement and to the guys and girls of our military, period. That's how we need to look at it. All right, this political correctness is going to kill us, ladies and gentlemen. It's going to suffocate each and every one of us. Okay? So, I want to move on to another area that is a lot of problems. Now, I said earlier, we talked about the definition of justice, that it's fair, and it is equitable, and it is proportional. So that word proportional, let's look at that. So if someone shoplifts in America, right, American justice, what is a proportional response to catching that person shoplifting? Well, it seems pretty simple. You catch the person shoplifting, they're arrested, they go to court, and if it's their first time, they will get a fine. That fine is proportional to what they did. You stole a pack of gum, and your fine is $500. It's the idea is that the fine should have some sting to it. The punishment, which is the fine, should have some sting to it so that you learn your lesson. But at the same time, it shouldn't be so harsh that you can't function. Like you steal a pack of gum and you sentence someone to 3 years in state prison. That would be totally unproportional. So proportionality is important for justice to exist. You must have proportionality in how you do things. So a first-time shoplifter would get a fine. Now they shoplift again. Now they get a more steep fine, a heavier fine, and they might get probation now, where now they have the burden of responding to probation, to registering, making phone calls, showing up at a probation office, speaking to a probation officer. The whole idea is that it is progressive. You know, you did one thing once and you didn't learn your lesson, or you ignored the lesson and you committed the same violation of society's rules again. Now the third time you shoplift, in many jurisdictions, this might be the time the judge might sentence you to jail. Actually, you go to the county jail for up to 364 days. So the judge might say, hey, you shoplifted three times, you didn't learn your lesson, you're on probation, and you continue to commit the crime. So therefore, now you're going to go think about it in the county jail for a year. Would you like to be sentenced to county jail for a year? Would you like to be sentenced to county jail for a day? I'm going to tell you, you would not. I know I would not. I would not want to be going to jail for any reason. I've been in lots of jails. They're not nice. They're not fun. There's nothing good about them. Being there is very difficult. Although some people do make a lifestyle out of going to jail. They repeatedly commit crimes, and it was strange to me. As a new cop, one of our jobs was we had to transport people to the jail. When we arrested them and they couldn't make bail, they would go to jail until they saw a judge. Or sometimes the judge would sentence people after court and we would have to drive them to jail, and off they go to jail for whatever their sentence time was, 2 days or 6 months, whatever it was. And I started to see the same faces. You know, the same people were repeatedly, over the course of a couple of years, be sentenced to 2 months in jail, 3 months in jail, getting arrested, no bail money, go to jail. And I would say to these people, you know, what are you doing? They're like, hey, listen, man, it's the cost of doing business. And I said, what do you mean the cost of doing business? Yeah, well, you know, I steal. I make a lot of money from stealing. But every once in a while you get caught, you got to go to jail. That's the cost of doing business. And I was shocked by that. I was shocked by that because that's so far from my experience in life. But there's lots of people who see it that way. Hey, it's the cost of doing business. You go to jail. You know, you pay your time. You do your time. All right. That's proportional to them. You see, that's proportional. They know, hey, I've gotten away with like 12 other crimes that I didn't get caught for, and I got snagged this time, and I got to go do 6 months in the county jail. Oh, well, they just take their time. They go do it because that's proportional to them. So a proportional response is part of justice. The concept of justice is that there should be proportionality. So we talked about the shoplifter, and after the third time, maybe they go to jail. Now let's talk about someone who kills somebody. In America, here in Pigeon Forge, Tennessee, we wake up today and we turn on the news and we say, man kills another man at a nightclub. You know, shoots him. Pulls a gun and shoots and kills him. And we say to ourselves, well, obviously, he killed somebody. They have to go to jail for the rest of their life. Or if you're in a state where there's the death penalty, maybe you get the death penalty. But even here, it's not that cut and dry. There's proportionality. We have to look at the reason that there was the conflict first. Was the guy who shot and killed the guy, was he defending himself? And in that case, justice would not say that if you're defending yourself, you felt like you were going to get killed yourself. Maybe the man had a knife. Maybe the man was just 10 times bigger than you, was going to beat you to death, and you happen to have a gun, and you shoot him and kill him to protect yourself. Justice then would dictate that you were acting in self-defense. You should have no punishment because you were defending yourself, right? People aren't allowed to just beat you or kill you or shoot you or stab you. You are allowed to defend yourself in most locations. Now, in some of our northern eastern states, they frown on the idea of defending yourself, even though it's on the books as a thing. It's a, you see a bigger problem, but that is another story for another day. In general, the concept of proportionality, of using deadly force, is all dependent on the circumstances around it. So that's not cut and dry. Then maybe you find out that the guy who got killed got into a fist fight with the man who killed him, and the man who killed him punched him in the face during this fist fight. The guy falls to the ground, hits his head on the stoop, the concrete stoop, or on the bottom of a chair, and busts his head, and he dies from that head injury. Well, that's not considered, you know, outright murder at that point, although it is considered a homicide. Right? The homicide is death by the hand of another human being. So he is, it's considered maybe manslaughter. It's a lesser charge because the intent wasn't to kill. The intent was to engage in a fist fight. And unfortunately, based on your actions of engaging in this fist fight, somebody ended up dying, and you're going to pay a penalty for that. And usually that penalty is, you know, between 9 and 15 years in prison. It's proportional, as opposed to the guy who wakes up that day and says, I'm going to go rob the local drug dealer, steal his money and his drugs, and I'll kill him if he fights back. And you go there, you end up shooting and killing the guy. That's a, you know, premeditated kind of a homicide. And that would be, you know, 30 years to life or the death penalty, because that's proportional to the crime. You know, one of the things that we look at is we have hate crimes legislation, which political correctness demands that we see it in a certain way. So what is the proportionality of hate crimes? The proportionality of hate crimes is this. If I shoot and kill you in the course of an argument, or if I kill you because I hate you, you're still just as dead. So why then are we playing around with this idea of a hate crime? That I killed you because I hate you is worse than I killed you because I wanted your wallet and you wouldn't give it to me. You know, the victim is still dead either way. So why is there this this whole idea of hate crimes legislation that because you hate, we're going to see it more harshly? Well, if we look at it proportionally, what we're trying to do with hate crimes legislation is that if someone's going to rob someone, because that's what they do, they rob and steal, and someone ends up dead, that's a horrible thing, and you pay the penalty for your actions. But if you hate someone, and you, the idea of your hatred expresses itself in violence, what we're trying to do is send a message to everyone else that this hatred will not be tolerated. And therefore, if it's less than a crime of murder, say you beat someone very seriously, or you do some other thing, and it's based on a motive of hatred, the penalty is enhanced, because we want the rest of society to understand that you can hate anybody you want, but you cannot act on your hatred. See, hatred is one of those human emotions that has caused death and misery for thousands of years. So the idea of hate crime legislation is to try and modify human behavior that says even if you hate somebody, you cannot act on that hatred. So we can have an argument about that too. Excuse me. Now, I know back in the day, when George Bush, the president, was running for office, there was a crime where a man was brutally murdered, an African-American man was brutally murdered in Texas, and they wanted to charge him with hate crime, and George Bush was against that because he said, the man is dead. Let's punish these people for killing the man. Let's not worry what they were thinking when they did it. And, of course, people went a little bit out of proportion in their response to him. Oh, he doesn't want hate crimes because he just hates people for this, that reason. He's a hater too. And none of that was true. It was, the man was just trying to look at it like I was trying to give the, what's the difference? The victim is dead. Let's punish the people who did this. What I'm trying to give you is the concept that I understand behind hate crimes legislation. Is that the idea is we want to help people control themselves. Because you can hate anybody you want in this country. I'm sure there's people that hate me. All right? But you can't act on your hatred. And we want society to know that. You can hate anybody you want, but acting on it is going to be a more severe penalty. Now, in the case of someone dying over a hate incident, you're just as dead if they hated you and killed you as if they just wanted your wallet. So I find that a little problematic. But if you beat somebody up and you hurt them, you permanently injured them, you blind them, you break their leg, whatever, because you hated them, your penalty should be more than that, because we're trying to send that message that you can't have hate. That is proportional to the crime we're trying to stop. See, so all of this proportionality comes together in the sense of justice. We're trying to find what is right and just, because proportionality, based on the definition I gave you, would then be fair and equitable, right? If it's proportional. So it's like the three legs of the stool, I guess, for justice. And it all kind of winds together in that. You know, proportionality is part of justice. You don't put a person in jail for 3 years for stealing a pack of gum the first time. But the third time, you put him in jail maybe for a year. That's proportional. You know, that's the whole idea of justice, is to come out to the best resolution of what is actually right, fair, proper, and proportional. So proportionality tells me we're at the end of round two, because I have to proportion my time that I spend here with you on Chasing Justice. So we'll be back in a minute for round three of Chasing Justice on the America Out Loud Radio Network.
I'm going to ask you to go to thewoundedblue.org. That's www.thewoundedblue.org. That is the website for the organization that is the National Association for Injured and Disabled Police Officers. It is a support organization for these men and women who have given so much in the line of duty. We desperately need your help to raise money to get this movement going. And if you are a GoFundMe-er, go to GoFundMe, look up The Wounded Blue, and you can give there as well. But check it out, please, and also check out our film, The Wounded Blue, on Amazon.com.
Think back to the last time you felt healthy and energized. The best times of our lives occur when we're at the peak of our health, sleeping better, full of energy and focus. We know that fades with age, and you might be feeling the effects of aging as low energy and poor sleep. But it doesn't have to be that way. There haven't been any nutrition systems designed to rejuvenate our bodies as we get older, until now. Healthy Cell Pro is the only multi-nutrient system that impacts the building block of your body, the cell. Created by anti-aging expert and Nobel Prize nominee, Dr. Vincent Giampapa, award-winning Healthy Cell Pro cuts through the complexity of nutrition supplements by simply giving you the purest ingredients, filling dietary gaps to nourish your cells and enhance your quality of life for optimal performance. Visit HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for an exclusive discount, or call 844-869-9958.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to round three here on Chasing Justice on the America Out Loud Radio Network. You know, I want to tell you a little bit about True Security Design, my company. I talk about it a little each week. One of the reasons I am here in Pigeon Forge, Tennessee this week is that my company is attending this convention to try and bring the training that I do to the law enforcement personnel. There's also a lot of school personnel here. And as you know, the school world is a big area that I concentrate on for safety and security. So TrueSecurityDesign.com is our website. I would like everyone to go there and take a look. Excuse me. We offer a lot of different training programs for businesses, for schools, and for law enforcement. We offer threat assessments for schools and businesses. We come in and we take a look at your facilities and make sure that they are safe. We look for the security gaps in your facilities, and then help you create a roadmap to repair those facilities so that you have a safe school, a safe working environment. One of the topics down here that I was talking to one of the people who are attending is that there's a lot of concern now from HR people, human resources people, about the danger to the workplace, because we know the workplace is actually more dangerous than the schools. The reason we worry so much about the schools is because it involves the most innocent among us, our children, and they are helpless when someone shows up with a weapon and starts killing. So we concentrate on the schools, but the workplaces are just, if not more, dangerous when it comes to the number of incidents that take place in those places, whether it be physical injuries or whether it be murders at the workplace. All right, so what we do is we go out and we help businesses. We do some specific training. We train everyone in your facility in crisis de-escalation techniques. All right, this is so someone starts to go off, someone is having a bad day, someone's screaming and hollering, a customer, a parent, a coworker, and it could potentially get violent. You know, you're going to try and call the police. Well, the police are not going to get there quick enough to help you. You had better have people in the building who have some idea of how to de-escalate a person so that they don't erupt into violence. And that's one of the trainings that we do. It's called Crisis in the Workplace. And when I do it for school personnel, it's called Crisis in the School, like Crisis in the Classroom. So True Security Design, we do both of those kind of trainings. We also do Surviving the Active Shooter. Now, this is extremely important because should someone arrive at your workplace and begin shooting, which happens, and that's what the HR people are really concerned about, we teach your entire staff how to look at their facility as a way to understand their environment so that something like that should happen. How do they respond? How do they run hide or fight kind of a thing? How do they get themselves out of that situation? How do they protect themselves? So truesecuritydesign.com, go take a look. And we are here to answer questions, to help you in any way, or your child's school. We can help them too. We have lots of products to help the school tighten up, lock down, evacuate, whatever you need. TrueSecurityDesign.com. Thank you for listening, and don't hesitate to give us a call. All right. I would also like everybody out there, I've been so thrilled by the response of everybody joining us on Twitter. It has really been great. So if on Twitter, it's at Pangaro Global, at Pangaro Global. So please go there and join us on Twitter, and I will follow you back, and we can have a conversation about what goes on in the world. It's part of continuing the Chasing Justice show. When we're not on the air here on America Out Loud, we can do it on Twitter. So please go there and at Pangaro Global, and let's hook up together. All right, so continuing our theme today of justice, and I think we found one of the linchpins that we've put here is that justice is reliant on proportionality. I think we've made that clear in the last two segments. So we apply this now to other areas that we see justice. And we saw recently that the Iranian government shot down an American military drone. Now, the first thing, you can be shocked by the price of the drone. You know, people are saying between $120 million and $180 million for the drone, but it is a very sophisticated piece of equipment. It brings great value to our military. We can use these drones to, as it's been explained to me, the cameras in these things are so fantastic that you get a drone up at 100,000 feet. You know, think about how high up that is, what, 14 miles in the air? And the camera can take a very detailed either video or pictures of about 2,000 square miles. You know, that's gigantic, and it can get very detailed pictures so our military can see what's going on the ground. They can see military bases, troop movements, vehicle movements. They can see people assembling missiles or whatever it is that they're doing. So it's a very sophisticated piece of equipment, and that's why it comes with a $120 million price tag. It can be flown accurately by a pilot sitting in an office on the other side of the world. These drones also come equipped with missiles, you know, Hellfire missiles or other similar type of missiles, and they can be used to as an attack platform for our military if they have to go into a dangerous situation and attack the enemy. They can do so without a human pilot in the seat that could be killed, injured, or captured. So the drones are really an amazing piece of equipment. So this one that was shot down by the Iranians had a wingspan, I think they said, of a 737. So that's pretty wild. I guess it's almost 100 feet, the wingspan. And it can fly for 24 hours. That's a really long time to fly, 24 hours. That's a lot of fuel. So it's an amazing device that we have, technology at our command. And the Iranians shot this down. So the first question is, was it over Iranian territory? Now, I think the Iranians have been people who have supported terrorism over the years. I think they have been responsible for the deaths of many, many, many American service people, not directly as the Iranian government, but by using their proxies that they have, you know, Hamas and these other groups that they support and finance around the world to cause mayhem and terror. The Iranians have been proved to be directly responsible for that, which is kind of funny because, and I don't mean funny, I mean funny, strange, that they are a known terrorist nation, but yet we still talk about them in the media as though they're just good old guys like the rest of the world. You know, they're just out there trying to run their country and do things. Meantime, they're a known terrorist nation, and we put up with them. Is that just? Would it be just to remove them? How many more people are going to die because of the actions of the Iranians? How many more American soldiers and perhaps civilians are going to die because of the actions of the Iranian government because we don't take it out? Now, that's a pretty harsh thing to say, right? Take out a government? The reality is they're constantly attacking us, constantly attacking our soldiers. Why are we taking that? Why are we putting our men and women in jeopardy because this government is constantly doing this? We saw that they attacked oil tankers in the Gulf. They did that to send a message to tell everybody that they control the Gulf. Of course, they wouldn't admit that they did it, but there's some pretty damning video out there that shows an Iranian patrol removing one of the unexploded bombs because they didn't want to leave evidence that it was them. So they're a little cowardly, I would say that. They do these things, but they don't stand up and say they do it because they know there could be retaliation. So my point being is that recently they've started to act out. They attack these boats. They support terrorist groups around the world. And then they just shot down an American drone. So where did they shoot down the drone? That's the first thing you have to look at. The understanding of sovereign borders, whether it's your enemy or yourself, is a concept that we all trying to adhere to. Okay, so the United States has sovereign borders. So if a foreign country flew their military aircraft over the United States, we would most assuredly confront them and, if not, shoot them down. I mean, recently, the Russians have been flying military planes very close to American airspace up near Alaska. And what do? We scramble jets up there and escort them away. All right, now they're testing us. I'm sure we're doing the same thing. We fly close to them. They send up escorts. Hey, you got to leave. You got to get out of here. You know, we're testing each other. It's a dangerous thing to do, but I think it's all part of military diplomacy, and that's just the way the world is, whether you like it or not. That's how people do these things. But we see if the drone was flying over Iranian airspace, I guess by the definition of it, they would be within their rights to shoot it down because it's over their airspace. It's an American military piece of equipment. It's over their airspace, and therefore they have a right to that sovereignty, and they could shoot it down, just like America would. If somebody sent a drone over Pigeon Forge, Tennessee, and it was a military drone from another country, we would probably shoot it down, right? Because that's the whole concept. So the Iranians shoot this down, and our president says that there's proof that it was over international waters. Now, that changes the picture. Now we are allowed to be in the airspace of international waters, and the Iranians shooting down our drone, I guess technically could be looked at as an act of war. They've taken a hostile act against a piece of our military equipment, which is against our military, and they've done so for an unprovoked reason. You're not allowed to just shoot down things over international waters. So technically, I guess you could say that it was burgeoning on an act of war by them doing that. So what are we supposed to do? What, as a country, what do we do? What is proportional in that response? And this is where I wanted to get to with President Trump and his response. But first, let's look at how this was greeted in the media, because I can hardly go a week without talking about the, you know, the fake news and how they are so anti-American. It's shocking to me. So President Trump comes out and he says he's going to take some action against the Iranians for doing this. And he comes out and he says, listen, we have proof, scientific proof, matter of fact, that the drone was in international waters when it was shot down. So what is scientific proof? He probably means there's video, digital video. There's probably radar mapping that was recorded that shows where the drone was when it was hit and this and that. So what he's trying to do is make the case that the United States was not violating Iranian airspace when the Iranians inappropriately attacked our drone. Right, trying to make justification for what is going to come next so that when the justice is administered by the president against the Iranians, there's solid backgrounds on which to do that because it would be a proportional and just response to their activities. So he says he makes the case that it was in international waters. And what does the media say? The media doesn't believe him. The media immediately takes the side of the Iranians that, well, Trump was probably just doing the wrong thing. And he's lying. He's lying. Can you imagine that? That these people would take the side of the Iranian government, even if they took it lightly and just said, well, Trump's probably lying. So he was probably over there and he, you know, we deserve to have it shot down because, you know, we're the bad guys in America, especially to our media. How frustrating. Anyway, so President Trump makes the case. It was in international waters. And he says, I can't really talk about what we're going to do, but you'll see what's going to happen. Now, that's the right response from the president. You don't want to give away your hand about what you're going to do because then your enemy can react. They can protect their assets. They can do lots of things if they know when and where the attack is coming. So he says, you'll see what's going to happen. So apparently, there was a target package that was put together by our military experts on here's the things that we can respond to, the way we can respond militarily. Proportionally to this attack, they shot down an unmanned drone worth $180 million in international waters, and they were doing a hostile act against America. Therefore, we have got to respond in kind. We have to go back, and we have to now slap their hand really hard so that the rest of the world sees, and we're not talking about Germany and France and England. We're not teaching them a lesson. We're teaching hostile actors, hostile governments around the world, that you don't do these kind of things, especially to America, or there is a price to be paid, a proportional price to be paid. So the military puts together a strike package. A strike package is a list of targets that you can certainly hit and what assets you would need to hit them. So do you use Tomahawk missiles? Do you use artillery pieces? Do you send troops? Do you send ships? You know, do you do an air campaign? Whatever it is that you do, there's the strike packages are set up so that the president has some choices. Now, with each one of those strike packages comes consequences. All right, if we send armed aircraft that are flown by people, you know, manned by humans, jet fighters or bombers, one of those bombers or multiple bombers or jets could be shot down. We could lose American military people in the response. So we have to figure out, is that something we want to do? Well, hey, guess what we have? We have other drones that are unmanned that can deliver military strikes in different places. But could they deliver it in the way that we need it? Would it be as impactful as it needs to be? We can certainly fire Tomahawk missiles, which are shot from the deck of some of our ships. They can go pretty far. They follow terrain. They have tremendous guidance systems. They present quite a punch when the weapons arrive on site. So that's something we could do. You know, do we go and we sink some ships using submarines or some other campaign? Do we sink some Iranian military boats, some Navy boats of theirs? What is our proportional response? So apparently President Trump got the strike packages from the military and he picked one that he wanted to do and he ordered the action to take place. We're going to use this strike package. We're going to go after them. And just before, according to him, even on the news, he said about a half an hour before the strike package was to be enacted and this retaliation was to take place, he asked a question. He asked a question of proportionality. He asked a question of justice. Now, we had an unmanned drone worth lots of money attacked inappropriately by the Iranians, who have been our enemy for many years. And he wanted to know how many civilians might die in this attack. Now, we can all be mad at the Iranians and say, well, too bad, civilians die, that'll teach them a lesson. The Iranian people are not our enemies. The Iranian people are not our enemies for the most part. It's the Iranian government that is the problem, that causes problem for the Iranian people. They subjugate them, they treat them horrible, they oppress them. So it's not the people who are our enemy. And if we have to strike back and civilians die, civilian casualties die in a necessary military attack, unfortunately, that's the way it is sometimes. It has to happen sometimes. You can't avoid it. But President Trump asked that question. What would be the civilian death toll? And he was told to be about 150 people. Now, that doesn't mean 150 of their government people. It means 150 people who are just going about their lives trying to survive their own government. And they would be killed in these attacks. So the president said, I call it off because it's not proportional to what they did. Now, $180 million, that's a lot of money. An American drone being shot down, an important piece of equipment being shot down, that's serious. But human life, the taking of innocent human life, even if it's our enemy, like the Iranians, was not proportional to shooting down a piece of equipment, and he called it off. Now, I think for sure there's going to be some type of other retaliation at some point. I think they're going to definitely do something. But I have to say, you know, now our media is saying, well, it looked like weakness in Trump's point. And I'm saying, is there any question in anybody's mind that if we wanted to, in the next 20 minutes, we could wipe out the Iranian government completely with a barrage that the world had never seen? And we could do it pretty easily, I would think. The fact that he was being just, looking at the proportionality of the response, I think he made the right decision. Now, I think we do need to strike them. We do need to hit them militarily. But I think we need to limit our targets to purely military targets. And we can certainly do that. But it's about proportionality, because that is what justice is. And I think we saw that from our president in the past event. So, ladies and gentlemen, we're at the end of round three here on Chasing Justice. I want to thank you all to be here, and I wanted to leave that thought with you. Proportionality. What is justice in your life? How does it work? Are you a just person? Do you mete out justice to those around you on little ways and in big ways? Right? So always remember, be a part of the solution, not a part of the problem. And we'll see you next week on Chasing Justice here on the America Out Loud Radio Network.